Outsides by MRS Pride is brought to you by our principal sponsor, YouGov.
Okay, so hello and welcome to the first MRS Pride podcast. My name is Sabrina. I'm client director at Motif. And before I joined Motif, I used to head up online communities offer for a range of different agencies. But I've been in the market research industry for about 10 years.
And I'm Josephine Hansom. I'll be co-host today. I'm the MD of Youth Site Research. As the name suggests, we look at young people as audiences, consumers or citizens. And I guess before I was doing youth research, I was at GfK for quite a long time. And then I worked at a political consultancy. So I'm 20 years now in the research business.
So we're super excited to have loads of guests here for our first podcast. And we wanted to bring together some amazing voices from across the industry and the community to inspire, learn and have a bit of a laugh, basically. So on today's show, we'll be bringing you the wonderful Sophia Papadopoulos and the unbelievable diva publisher Linda Riley, who will be talking about some recent groundbreaking research that they've just taken part in. And also we will be speaking to Ollie Robertson about his experiences being a gay man in a variety of different environments across the market research industry. So over to you.
Thank you very much, Sabrina. So our first segment is all about some really interesting research. Let's speak to Sophia Papadopoulos to find out a little bit more about what she does and her role in the piece of research that we're about to discuss.
Yeah, hi, thanks for having me. I'm Sophia Papadopoulos. I work at Kantar. I've been at Kantar for 7 years, I think, now. Makes me pretty much a lifer, I think. I started my career at Kantar as a market researcher, but personally realised that it wasn't really for me. So a couple of years ago, switched over into a technology role within Kantar. So I'm a senior business analyst. I help to build some of our software, basically. As well as that, I lead our global Pride at Kantar group. We've been going for a couple of years now. We're up to about 700 members, which is great.
So Linda, I've done a little bit of Googling about you, I'm afraid. And I've got quite a long list of bullet points here that I know I haven't even covered it all off of what you've achieved and done as a businesswoman, but also for the community. So I could name a few, obviously publishing Diva, but you know, you were a board member of GLAAD, you're a patron of AKT, an organisation for you, sort of important to me as sort of young people in the LGBTQ area who are facing homelessness. Patron also for the charity Action Breaks Silence, empowering women to protect themselves against physical and sexual assault. I'm sure I haven't stolen too much of your introduction.
My name is Linda Riley. I'm the publisher of Diva magazine. For those of you who don't know, it's the number one brand for LGBTQI women. It's been going since 1994. But I also do various other things. I do the European Diversity Awards, the British Diversity Awards, and I'm also a patron for Diversity Role Models. And most important for me is that I'm the mother of two 13-year-old twins as well. And I don't know where I get the time for everything before you ask me.
Wow.
Yeah, wow. That's a big wow. Could I start just by asking, Linda, so what prompted you to start Diva?
Yeah, well, I didn't actually start Diva. It started in 1994, but I became publisher in 2015. It was never before owned actually by LGBTQI woman, so it was owned by Gay Times. It was like traditionally the little sister, if you like. So what I wanted to do, I mean, Diva was obviously a very very well-established brand. I actually didn't know how well it was loved until I took it over. But what I wanted to do was to bring it to the forefront and make it not just being a magazine, but an actual brand in itself. Mm-hmm. For example, what we started doing things like the Diva Awards. There'd never been an awards before for LGBTQI women, you know, a black tie sit-down dinner. So that was very exciting. We started as well the Diva Literary Festival. So I wanted to do things around women's interest with Diva and make it more of a magazine because, you know, in the old days when it was started in 1994, obviously that was many of you here won't remember, but it was pre-internet days, you know, so it was like so many people have come up to me and said that Diva was like their lifeline because they didn't actually, you know there were other women like them that existed.
If you can, I definitely can connect with that. I remember I was a teenager. I worked at a news agent, so I had an array of magazines at my disposal every Saturday when I would work there. And it wasn't until I saw Diva on the shelves and was stocking it alongside all the other, like, you know, Just 17s and other magazines that I was like, yeah, it made me realise that maybe, yeah, what I was thinking or feeling was actually not, I wasn't alone.
Yeah, no, so many people have said that and that they you know, they would take it home and hide it, you know, in their house somewhere. And it really did. I realised how much it meant to people. I was still quite upset, even in 2015 when I became publisher. We did launch a big campaign to keep it off the top shelves because for some reason, you know, Diva is a lesbian lifestyle magazine, you know, and it was deemed in the shop to be somehow pornographic, which, you know, I fought a very hard campaign with a certain brand, which I won't name, to try and get it off the top shelves, you know. But even though the brand, they agreed that they wouldn't put it on the top shelves anymore, you know, when it was going to the shops, the people that work in the shops wouldn't take it off. So, you know, there's always a struggle with Diva, that's all I can say.
Could you tell us a little bit more about the Diva Awards?
So many people have come up to me that have had awards at my event and just said how much it had changed their lives and, you know, what it meant to them, what it meant for, you know, for the corporate sector when they went back. They're setting benchmarks for other people to try and sort of keep up with them, etc. They really are game changers, awards, and it's really, you know, it's indescribable to say what they mean to people. And what I wanted to do with Diva was something quite different because I've had all this experience in doing awards. But what I wanted to do, and people were actually telling me this won't work, which was to start an awards event for predominantly women. Obviously, men were welcome and mm-hmm. are welcome as allies, you know, but predominantly the event is 80% LGBTQI women, which is really... when you go out to events, LGBTQI events, it's unknown. You know, the British LGBTI Awards, for example, were 80% men, you know. So I just wanted to turn things around a bit and do stuff for women. That was, I was almost at a point in my career when I wanted to just do more for women because mm-hmm. so little had been done over the years.
How does all of this fit in to the research?
So how it fits in is that as I became more involved in Diva, because, you know, I was still quite, and I still am involved with the European Diversity Awards, but it was just, for me, the LGBTQI women was just a strand that didn't feel recognised enough, you know, and particularly with LGBTQI women, all the infighting was coming into play. You know, unfortunately, a small aspect of LGBTQI women weren't accepting trans women as women and as lesbians. So I wanted to do quite a lot to show that Diva was an ally to LGBTQI women. But at the same time, I wanted to show that I also supported L and lesbian visibility. So I decided to do an event at Diva, which was basically celebrating lesbians, raising the visibility of cis lesbians, but also saying we are actually trans allies. There was already Lesbian Visibility Week, which had been Lesbian Visibility Day, which had been going for 12 years. And I just thought that's just not enough visibility. You know? So let's just go for this and have a week. And obviously you mentioned earlier that I was a board member of GLAAD and I asked them to support it in the USA. Stonewall also supported the week. And, you know, once you get people like that on board for supporting, the week just took off.
When it actually is the week, just for people who are listening, so they might have missed it. Yeah. And what sort of happens in that week?
Yeah, so Lesbian Visibility Day has traditionally been April the 26th. So we based a week around that day. What we're trying to do, and you know, we trended all over Twitter, you know, there were so many articles in the mainstream press. What we did around it, we had to, obviously it was during times of COVID, so we had to make the week virtual, but we planned a big Diva Awards around that week. We launched a research we did with Kantar, which I'll talk about with Mandy in a minute. So what we did was try to put on a virtual workplace conference for LGBTQI women. So there was lots of events, and next year, obviously, that's going to grow. So people, it will be, what we want to see is it will get to the point where people aren't talking about Lesbian Visibility Day anymore. They're actually seeing it as a week, a bit like Lesbian LGBT History Month, for example. Mm-hmm.
So Sophia, would you like to tell us a little bit about how Kantar got involved here, if possible?
Yeah, sure. So we had been working with Linda on a couple of different bits and pieces. We'd been involved in the European Diversity Awards and that sort of thing for a little while. And Linda approached us about, you know, wanting to do a survey of, you know, LGBTQI women. And we jumped at the opportunity. It really was that simple, to be honest. We were very keen to, you know, be part of what we felt was going to be a really important piece of work as a member of the community. I know full well that LGBTQI women are very much under-researched. You know, we searched high and low when trying to pull together our questionnaire for inspiration, you know, what else can we use and that sort of thing, and there really isn't that much out there. So, you know, to be part of something like that is pretty amazing.
Well, yeah, it's surprising, isn't it, that it's taken this long for this type of research to be undertaken. What sort of standout findings? I guess that there are some that you have talked about quite a lot, but are there others that you haven't necessarily managed to talk about as much as you'd like?
For me, a lot of it was kind of confirming what I already thought of as a gut feel. So the idea that, you know, gay men are far more represented in the media than LGBTQI women. That came through overwhelming. That, and I think just the real need for LGBTQI spaces. Like, I think, you know, in London, we've seen so many of those disappear over the years, and so many of them that are female focused as well have just disappeared over the years. And I think that is really, that's not a good thing. In my book, I think we need those spaces. And when I say, you know, female, I mean all women. So we saw some real differences in the language that's used across generations. So there's, you know, slightly older LGBTQI women are more likely to be okay with the word dyke, whereas there are those who are sort of younger than that are far less likely to be okay with it, but are more likely to be okay with the word queer, whereas the older generation are, you know, not so okay with that one.
Younger generation are growing up and experiencing you know, life and identifying themselves in a very different way that we, all of us here, sort of were able to when we were young, which is nothing but a good thing. There's so much more freedom for them to experiment and freedom just to consider and think about rather than shut away and try and suppress, which many of us did when we were younger. Were there any other kind of, it was age one of the big differences in terms of the research, sort of seeing the differences in the generations?
Definitely. Aside from the language, the other key difference, in the age groups was around the age that people are coming out. I don't think any of us will be surprised by that, but it was really interesting to see, like, at what age people are coming out versus what age they are now. So far, far more likely to come out when they are younger, if they are young now, than in the past. But interestingly, a lot of those who come out, you know, if they're 16 to 24 now, they're likely to have already come out, but they actually go back in the closet when they go to work, which I...
Interesting.
Yeah, I found that really interesting and kind of a little bit sad, but it made me realise just how important employee resource groups actually are in helping people see that you can bring your whole self to work and it's all good. I thought that was quite an interesting one.
Well, that's a great segue, because I wanted to ask a little bit more about the work you're doing at Kantar. And yeah, how did you get to set up your group? Was it easy, hard? If people listening wanted to do it themselves, yeah, tell us about what happened.
Yeah, so we started, we have an online platform that we use at Kantar. We're a global company, so this platform has really enabled us to work much more internationally with each other, let alone with our clients. So we share knowledge a lot more than I think we did in the past. And when we launched it, I'd been thinking for a while that, you know, I couldn't be the only LGBTQI person in the whole of Kantar. There was absolutely no way. But I didn't know who the others were, and I didn't know how to reach out to them. So I just set up a group. And I thought, if in a year's time we've got 100 members, I'll be super happy. And we actually had that within a week, which was, nobody was more surprised than me. But it was brilliant, and it has been brilliant. And I think what I love about it is it's properly been a grassroots movement. I am not a senior person within Kantar, but I just did it. I didn't ask anyone for permission. I just went ahead and did it. And I think that's, you know, the first thing I would say to anybody. If you think that this is important enough to do, do it. You are doing good. You're not doing anything bad here. So go ahead and do it. And the things we've been focusing on, there's three key areas that we've really focused on over the last couple of years. One is around kind of supporting our staff. Like, what do we need to do to be a supportive network? What do we need to do with HR to make sure that policies around the world are LGBTQI friendly? Do we need a global policy around, you know, if you're a colleague in a country that is not so gay friendly, what's our stance on that as a company, as an international company? And I think having a strategy and the things that you want to accomplish is super important in all of this. Even in the early stages, like if I think back to when we were like 3 months old, what was our strategy? What were we trying to do? It was all about raising awareness and getting engagement. And we've evolved that. So that would be my second top tip. and my third top tip, and this is the trickiest one to try and get and accomplish, is to actually find someone in a really senior leadership position who is an ally and get them to be your executive sponsor. It took us a long time to get to that point. And we are very fortunate to have the amazing Caroline Frankham be our executive sponsor. She sits on Kantar's global board. She's an absolute ally and a massive advocate for everything that we do. But what it's done for us is it's moved us on from being purely grassroots to actually being able to influence strategy and influence policy and all of that sort of thing. It means we've got a voice at the board. So she will regularly at board meetings actually talk about the Pride at Kantar group, So it's just raised our awareness from being purely grassroots to actually being able to influence more and more. So that would be my three things that I'd really focus on if you're trying to set up your own employee resource group.
Oh, what a journey, though. from starting a little kind of group forum thing on your internet to having someone represent you guys on the board. That's amazing. So what's next for, I guess, both of you? What's this research inspiring you to do next? Linda, can I ask that one to you first, please?
Yeah, well, for me, I'm talking quite extensively to Stonewall because I do want things to grow. What stood out for me with this research is that I was looking for stuff to compare it to. Like, for instance, as a mother myself, a big point of the research that came up and received masses of press attention was that 36%, I think it is, Sophia, 36% of children of LGBT parents had faced, homophobic abuse, which was, not even to say they were LGBT, it's just because their parents were. Mm-hmm. And that was pretty shocking. But one question that was asked of me, well, how has this changed since maybe 10 or 20 years ago? And the fact is, there'd never been research like this before, which was quite shocking to me. But I'm hoping that this research for the future will set a benchmark so that if research like this is done again in the future, that people may be able to look for, look back in 10 years' time and go, this is decreased.
Brilliant. And Sophia, anything that you can see on the horizon from this project or sort of future things at Kantar?
I think for Kantar, from the Pride at Kantar perspective, what I'm really hoping is that we keep growing, that we keep going, and that we keep inspiring our colleagues and that sort of thing. I think from Kantar's perspective, selfishly, I want us to become known for this sort of research, to be seen as experts, laying down the gauntlet there to a few competitors, I'm sure. but, I for me, that would be great. I think what I would love to see is, as an industry, us getting better at this. I don't think we research those, niche, and I say that in inverted commas, communities half as much as we should. We don't push our clients to do it where we absolutely should. Why do we do research on makeup but we don't necessarily look specifically at LGBTQI women? There's an absolute market for that there, but we don't know about it. We should, because our clients need to.
So that's probably a perfect way to end this section. Thank you very much. Over to Sabrina for the next segment.
Thanks, guys. That was really, really interesting. And I think, we've talked about this topic quite a lot, but there's always more things to talk about and more kind of pushing to do. So I think that's kind of, like you're saying, something that we should always kind of continue to look at. So next up, we have Ollie, who has joined us. I'll do a little intro for you, Ollie, but otherwise I'm going to pass over to you to do your own intro. But this section, really, we're looking at kind of shedding a bit of a spotlight on individuals within the industry and just like focusing a little bit more on kind of your career and your experiences around the market research industry. Because as we all know, and we've talked about before, all of our experiences have probably been quite different coming up through the years in the ranks. And I'm sure there's a lot of people who are listening who are at various stages. So we'll talk about kind of, things that you've experienced, but also advice and stuff like that. So you, and I've done a bit of research into you. This is your own words, so if this isn't right, then. So Ollie's been in the industry for about 17 years. And probably seen many changes. You currently head up the research function at Thinkbox, And Thinkbox is a marketing body for UK commercial TV, promoting the medium through credible industry-leading insight on behalf of UK commercial broadcasters. Is that right?
That's right. You got that from my LinkedIn profile, didn't you?
I've shamelessly taken that. Thanks for coming on the show. So yeah, just let us know a little bit about kind of what your role is at the moment. And how that's kind of working for you at the moment.
Well, thanks very much for asking me. I feel very honoured to have been asked to appear on your podcast, and certainly alongside such inspirational other guests, Linda and Sophia. I think it's fantastic. The work you're doing is really, it really is inspirational. So, I think that's fantastic. But thank you for that intro, Sabrina. That was good. Yeah, all spot on. So I'm Ollie. I have been working. Well, I currently work at Thinkbox, as you rightly said, is in the TV industry. But I've been working. I've been working in various roles, really. I suppose I always just, when people ask me what I do for a job, I always struggle a little bit because I'm never quite sure what to say, because I generally describe myself as a media researcher, really. That's ultimately what I've done. And I've worked in a variety of places, from media owners, trade bodies, agencies over the years. And it's been quite varied, but it's also been really interesting as well.
How did you find yourself at your first role, or maybe your first or second role, like choosing, I guess, or maybe not choosing, to come into media research?
Well, it was completely by accident, if I'm honest. It was a really, it was a very sort of weird, long and winding road, because I sort of fell out of university, having done a degree in French, and didn't really know what I was going to do, and returned home like many other graduates, and this would have been the early noughties, returned home to my family home, and just had to find a job. My mum was quite quick to say, you need to start paying rent, you've got to earn some money, and so I needed to find a job, and I just started applying for anything that looked like it might vaguely employ me, and I always describe it as blagging, because I think I was blagging it, really. But I managed to blag a job at my local newspaper, and it was for a stats analyst role. Now, bearing in mind, I mean, I'd had an A level in maths, but I certainly hadn't done anything numeric or analytical. It was just a bit of a laugh. It was a bit of a joke, really. I don't know how I managed to get the job, but I think they just liked me and felt sorry for me. And I talked a lot in the interview, so I think that might have been why. Maybe they couldn't find any room. But weirdly, I loved it, and I got on really well there. And but I realised it was not necessarily the culture I wanted to work in particularly, it certainly wasn't somewhere that I felt I fitted particularly well, but that led me to my next job in media, which was in London, working in print and working in press, and that was really the beginning. So it was completely by accident, and I went from being more of an analyst to moving into research, because I was curious and I just sort of wanted to get involved in various bits and pieces. And the company that I was working for at the time, the Newspaper Society, they had a research team, and I basically was just being nosy and kept asking questions about the research, and they sort of asked me if I wanted to join the research team. So that's how it all began, and led on to various other roles in research.
And when you kind of say it wasn't quite the culture or the environment that you were kind of first expecting, do you think that is something that's, I guess, really important for you as someone kind of going out into finding your place in as a career? Do you have any kind of thoughts around that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think when I think about the biggest challenges sometimes that I've had in any role or any particular organisation, I think a lot of it's being down to culture, and whether or not I feel that I have fitted in there, or whether it's the culture where they make anyone feel that they can fit in, no matter who they are, and in those early days, it was interesting. I think listening to what Sophia was saying a moment ago about the findings that came out of the research that they did for Diva, I completely my experience of going into the workplace was exactly that. It all coincided. I started that job at my local newspaper in the same month that I met my still partner, and I came out to my family, which was no great surprise to them, to be honest, and it all happened at the same time. And I think going into that workplace, I think I had no role models. I had no gay role models. I didn't know what was accepted in the workplace. I didn't know whether or not being gay in the workplace, I didn't know what reaction it was going to be. It was my first job out of university.
We talked a little bit about kind of the culture of inside work versus kind of outside work as well, kind of, but still with work colleagues. So that kind of weird interplay where you just touched on about kind of talking about your weekends and holidays and where you're spending your time. And again, like, I'm sure we've all had these experiences of kind of either not really being, just being a bit vague about what you're doing, or kind of just being a bit tentative, I guess, about who you're talking to and things like that. And I guess, just did you have any of those kind of experiences along the way, perhaps, around that difference in, okay, this is an inside work professional kind of environment to we're all down the pub having a drink and we're just sharing our stories?
Yeah, I mean, I think when I think back to some of the things that I suppose I have experienced over the time, and I think it gives you an indication of how things have changed, but also probably how things haven't changed as well, is, I mean, especially in the media world, there was a very, very alpha male blokey culture which prevailed in lots of the organisations that I worked in. And it was quite obvious that was quite a dominant culture. I have to say, in certainly some of the companies I've worked in, that changed while I was there very dramatically. But yeah, 100%. Now, the things that we just used to accept as being okay to say in the workplace or down the pub, yeah, would never be accepted now. I think I told you once before about something that really stuck in my mind was years ago working in an agency, and there was always this joke about, there was always this thing about drinks, what you drank down the pub, or what was acceptable to drink at various times of the year. And an email used to go out once a year when somebody would send it round, and I think this had been going on for years and years, where they would say that it was lager tops and rosé season, and that specifically the men were allowed to drink lager tops, the women were allowed to drink rosé down the pub. So it was now acceptable, and that season was open. And of course, I remember seeing this email when I was there for not long. I thought, what the hell is that all about? So there's now some sort of, you have to have some sort of permission to drink a certain type of drink down the pub. And it seems a bit ridiculous, doesn't it? But to think that, but I can remember going down the pub in the first month and, feeling that you had to drink. I had to drink a pint. What if I didn't want to drink a pint? And the thing that I really remember was someone, a senior straight man, coming out of the pub holding a small glass of red wine, and some of the sort of blokier blokes saying, what are you drinking there? And he said, I'm drinking a glass of red wine, thanks. And they said, what are you drinking that for? And he said, piss off, I'll drink what I want, thanks very much. Yeah. And I can remember thinking at that point, this is a good model for that confidence. It doesn't really matter who you are, but I think it's seeing somebody have the confidence to just challenge someone, and yes, he was a straight man, and yes, he fitted in lots of other ways. I suppose it gave me confidence that it's all right to, even on the most maybe superficial of things, like a drink, what you just drink down the pub, it's okay. And it's important to be seen saying those things as well. And it's an important message, and it's an important signaling for younger and less experienced colleagues who might be there. So I think that's definitely something I've always taken through to the rest of my working life.
That definitely came through in the Diva survey that, people are made to feel uncomfortable at work, whether it's inadvertent or on purpose, who knows? But there was a significant proportion that had been made to feel uncomfortable. And that was backed up by, 27% of those that have been made to feel uncomfortable didn't feel that they could raise it, which I think speaks volumes about the culture of where they work. That A, that bad behaviour is appropriate, but B, you can't even do anything about it. Yeah, so I think it does happen more than we recognise. And to your points earlier, I think that's where, those who are so open about who they are, I definitely see myself as someone who I'm trying to be the role model that I never had, or that I haven't really had. I don't see anybody around the business that is exactly like me or represents me, but actually I'll take bits from all of the different people that I do look up to and be that person for those that are coming through next.
And I think that's why we feel as well that the MRS Pride Committee is also part of that as well, just to be there, to be present. And also when you go to an event, when we used to be able to go to events, and but also see people and hear people like us just chatting.
And also, I think, smash some stereotypes as well.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, the clumsy things that people have said to me over the years, and none of them are particularly offensive, but, you know, I think it's really important to challenge people on what they say. I mean, I remember quite a close colleague once saying to me, I can't remember what the comment was. I said something along the lines of not liking musicals, and she basically said, what kind of a gay are you?
Oh my gosh.
And I remember thinking, how can you possibly ask me that? Or a common one was often people really being shocked when I told them how long I'd been with my partner for, and how long people said, I thought in your community that's people went, that's quite unusual, right? And I'm like, less unusual than you might think.
It's probably worth mentioning that the MRS has just launched their new mentoring program this year. And part of that program, there's a new LGBTQ plus sort of mentoring element. Yep. So just for people listening, that's something that you should really sort of check out. It's the first time this year. Scheme's been running forever, really great mentors. So yeah, something that could maybe help you navigate some of those awkward times. That in and out of work stuff, coming out of work, just general work things as well.
So moving on slightly then to kind of, I guess, more of a lockdown chat in terms of how did, I guess, yeah, it's been a long period of time. Some of us are still in lockdown. Some of us not really venturing out that much. How have you been? And did you learn any new hobbies? Did you do anything different? Did you learn to bake sourdough bread, as everyone seemed to have been doing? Or do you have any, I guess, recommendations of what you managed to achieve or what you didn't manage to achieve and you don't mind?
I mean, well, I can tell you for one, I wish that I could say that I had learnt a new hobby or a new skill, but I would be lying if I did. It's been strange for everybody, but where I live in a rural Cambridgeshire village where there aren't very many people, so to be honest, it's just been a bit like life as usual within the village. Hasn't been that different. I tell you what I have got as a recommendation. I'm sure everybody on listening will know about it already, and I was very late to the party, but early in lockdown, one of my discoveries, it was a recommendation from a colleague, was the TV program Schitt's Creek. Any of you watched that before?
I just started, on Wednesday. I think we watched the first three just in a row.
Yeah, it is. So it's a sitcom. It's a Canadian sitcom, just 20 minutes an episode. And I had no preconceptions. I didn't know what it was about. It's really funny. But as much as it's funny, it's also hugely heartwarming. It's got a huge representation of the LGBTQ community. It is just, I've become slightly obsessed, and I'm not the one sort of person who's ever become obsessed with a TV show before, but I went through six seasons over the course of lockdown, and this was a sad week because we finished the last episode on Sunday, and I feel slightly bereft, if I'm honest, because I would just encourage anyone to go and watch it. It's beautiful, and I would say life enriching as much as it is hilariously funny.
Wow.
As well.
I don't know if anyone can top that. That sounds amazing. So, Viv, have you got any tips or tricks or anything you got up to fill the time?
Mate, I totally learned how to make sourdough bread.
Yeah.
I became that person. Our neighbour gave us some starter for our sourdough. We've still got it alive. We've become those people in my household. So what did we get up to? I mean, our lockdown was a little bit stunted because my wife managed to go for a cycle ride on the first Monday and break her wrist, which meant that we were even more limited on what we could do.
Oh, wow.
For a while, which was, yeah, not great fun. Do not recommend going into lockdown and then needing to go to hospital and going for surgery. God bless her. She's fine now, absolutely fine now. She's got pretty much full motion back. I definitely took up, I didn't start new hobbies, but I picked up old hobbies that I'd let go of. So I'm quite interested in like typography and sign writing. So I got back into it more than I had done in the past and kind of been painting and that sort of thing, which is pretty good fun.
Very relaxing.
Yeah, it's been pretty cool. Yeah, and computer games. I didn't realise I enjoyed them as much as I do.
What are you going to do when we have to go back into the office?
I'm never going back. Don't tell Kantar, but I'm never going back, ever. It's not happening.
Linda, do you have any tips or tricks for us?
Well, I'm going to go into a little bit negative space here because I started COVID with COVID. I started COVID with lockdown, so I spent a lot of lockdown the first 2 months recovering because I developed pneumonia. But on the bright side, I spent the second half of lockdown really glad that I recovered. So there's the bright side, and also I spent a lot of time with my kids, quality time. I did my first ever interview with one of my kids, and she was saying stuff that I hadn't really realised, that, you know, how good it was to be able to do stuff with me together and have me there and stuff like that. So there's lots of positive sides to it, you know. I learned how to make carbonara with her. She taught me. So there you go. There's my excitement of lockdown.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Well, sorry to hear that you had it at the beginning, but obviously great that you got through it and you're with us still.
And you managed to put on stuff in Pride Month and fundraise all that money. I feel watching Netflix and maybe eating too many biscuits is not the achievement I thought it was. Never mind. I won't share.
I was very jealous of all the, everywhere I went, people were talking about all the Netflix series they were watching. And I was like, what's going on? You know, what? It's not fair.
I think that quality time, like, everyone's managed to get much more time back with the people around them. So I think that's been one clear kind of benefit, I think, for most people. Shall we move on to our Pride of the Pods?
Tell us more about it. What is the Pride of the Pod?
Pride of the Pod, which is a hashtag Pride of the Pod. So we want everyone to get involved. There's a call out for everyone who's listening and you guys on the podcast as well. We're just a bit of fun, really, just to say like one or two things, you know, every time you feel proud of yourself for doing something or maybe someone else, just to tweet it. Tweet it at, use the hashtag Pride of the Pod and then also tweet at MRS Pride. That would be great. Anything that you're proud of, really. So I was pretty proud of the fact that I showed my mum how to use WhatsApp video call. For the first time ever, she was like, oh my God, I can see you. And I was like, yep, that's how it works. I couldn't really see her because she was sitting like right next to a window and it was so dark. She just looked like a complete shadow, but it was fine. But, you know, we got through it. So that was my pride. We had a couple of other tweets that came through. So Sarah Heatley at MRS, I'm very proud of not killing my husband and disguising the body as a new lockdown garden project through lockdown. So things are going on there, which we won't ask about.
Just before lockdown, we got a second dog, which was a rescue dog that happened completely by accident. And he came to us. He was quite neglected. He was overweight. He had some really quite severe confidence problems. And lockdown has actually been brilliant because we've had a lot of time to concentrate on him. And I'm pleased to say that he is developing brilliantly. And he's certainly lost a lot of weight. And he's a much more confident little dog than when he first arrived with us. So I feel quite proud about that.
Oh, that's lovely. You need to show us a picture of him.
His name's Hades, and I didn't name him, by the way. It's a name that that raises a lot of eyebrows, especially when you're shouting it across the park.
The daughter Hades.
I've got one. So basically, I'm not very technical at all. And then, I had to do lots of stuff at home. And during COVID, we set up a Diva Facebook community for LGBTQI women as a kind of, you know, a little bolt hole. And one of the things I had to do, well, I set up these things called the Riley interviews, and I was interviewing, you know, celebrities and stuff in the community. But I had to get very technical on my own and basically record live and then play it live through the Facebook group and stuff like that. So I'm very proud of doing that. It might not be an achievement to all you technical bods listening, but to me it was like some achievement.
Can you share what celebrities you were interviewing?
Well, yeah, I can. I mean, one was really embarrassing because it was, here's an age one, I'm going to test you, Josephine. Sam Fox.
No? Oh, of course, Samantha Fox.
But that one was a bit embarrassing because my kids were upstairs and they were using up all my Wi-Fi and we couldn't get online, and it was like, you know, like the time was ticking away and I had to go upstairs and bribe them to come off the internet. But Denise Welsh, Dawn Butler, Sophie Ward, Rachel Shelley from The L Word, Horse, Heather Peace. Yeah, so quite a few.
Wow.
Amazing.
I've been doing a sort of lockdown haircuts for my wife since we've been unable to go to the hairdressers. And she has said that she wants me to continue. So I'm quite proud of my very basic bob that I'm able to give her and that she feels that I can continue without any shame in front of other people. Because
do you think you'll be able to persuade her to actually pay you to do it?
that's what I should be going for, that actually. Yeah, more cups of tea in the morning. Yeah.
Thanks to everyone, all of our guests, for joining us. I think we've had an excellent first podcast, if I say so.
Thank you so much. Yeah, it's been brilliant.
Great to catch up with you all. We have a few sneak peeks for the next podcast. We hopefully will be speaking to someone from the newly launched Core Group, which is the Colour of Research group. And yeah, we'll hopefully be talking a little bit more about that with some new guests. And we would love to hear from you guys. So please get in touch with us. Tell us what you thought, if you liked it, if you disliked it, what you want to hear more of.
If you disliked it, please be kind.
Yes, be kind. Email address mrs.pride@mrs.org.uk. Or you can tweet us at @tweetmrspride. And I think that's everything.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks very much for having me.